One of the ways some people are trying to solve the nation's opioid epidemic is through medication-assisted treatment. These medications are a powerful weapon in the fight against opioid abuse, but some people think they can perpetuate the problem. I'm Ann Hillman. Today on Talk of Alaska, we'll discuss what the medications actually do and when they can be the right tool for recovery.
Today's program is underwritten in part by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network. Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Welcome back. Today on Talk of Alaska, we're discussing using medications to treat opioid addictions. What works? What doesn't? Today in the studio, my guests are Serena Espinoza with Fallen Up Ministries, who's in recovery, and Carl Soderstrom, one of the founders of the peer support network Fiend to Clean. And joining us from KGZZ in Arizona is Nick Stavros, the CEO of Community Medical Services, which also has a clinic in Wasilla. Thank you all very much for joining us. And listeners, do you have experiences using medication to treat addictions? Do you have any questions about how they work? Call us at 1-800-478-8255 or 550-8422 in Anchorage. You can also email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. So, Nick, I'd like to go through the three main medications that are used to treat opioid addictions. And I was wondering if we could start with methadone. Like, what is that and what does it do?
Yeah. First of all, thanks for having me here today and working out a way for me to call in from Tempe, Arizona. So methadone is one of the three FDA-approved medications used to treat opioid use disorder. Methadone is derived from an opiate, just like Suboxone or buprenorphine is. But it's actually got more physiological properties to natural endorphins than it does to opiates. And so it is, it's often been called the gold standard of treatment. It's got more research behind it than any treatment for any chronic disease in the history of the world. There's tons of studies and meta-analyses that look at methadone treatment in particular as a means of treating opioid use disorder. And so it's given to patients in a very, very highly controlled and regulated environment. A patient has to come into an opioid treatment program once a day for the first 90 days to receive the medication because it is it's an opiate. It's dangerous if not administered properly. People can get high from it if it's abused, and it has a high overdose potential if it's not dosed properly as well. But when it's given in the proper doses, it stabilizes a person's brain. A lot of times people who have been using opioids for a long period of time, and brain scan technology has told us this for years, their brain becomes fundamentally changed, their brain chemistry. And so methadone helps, and Suboxone, normalize the brain chemistry so that patients using the medication don't go through withdrawals or cravings. So it really just stabilizes the brain. And if used properly, like I said, and administered in the right dose, it doesn't cause any euphoria. It's a very slow acting opiate. So it doesn't give you a rush like heroin would. And so it's typically not used to get high, but it's also, there's a lot of safeguards in place to prevent it from being abused in an opioid treatment program. And I just want to mention opioid treatment programs are the only type of facility in the country that can actually give out methadone for the treatment of addiction.
Okay. It's not available just through a primary care doc.
You can't go to a doctor. You could go to a pain practice and get methadone pills. You could get a 90-day supply for methadone right now for 90 days for the treatment of pain, but for the treatment of addiction, you have to go through, you know, that 90-day daily dosing routine and earn privilege levels and receive counseling, and there's all sorts of safeguards in place.
I'd like to get back to that in a little bit. Serena, do you have experiences with methadone?
I do.
Tell me a little bit about why and is it kind of as Nick described?
I was prescribed methadone for pain. So I know how methadone affected me. from somebody who's taken methadone, it got me high. And I was on a stabilized dose for 3 years, 100 milligrams. And every day I took it, I was getting high. Now I'm not against any maintenance medications, but my experience with methadone was that it definitely kept me high. I would nod.
What do you mean you would nod?
Like when I was relaxed, I would nod out and like my eyes would close and, you know, I'd kind of fall asleep where I was sitting or standing.
But you were given a dose for pain. Does that make a difference? That was it like a higher dosage than it would have been for treatment of addiction? Or
everybody that goes to the methadone for addiction, there it varies on the individual. Mm-hmm. So I've seen, you know, individuals at low doses of methadone and then, you know, higher doses. And when they go in to get their dose, it's all at once. My medication was prescribed to me throughout the day. But my doctor did say if you needed to take, you know, like half your dose in the morning, half a night, you could do that. And sometimes I would do that. So I don't think it matters, but every individual is different as well. So,
okay. So, I mean, I guess, Nick, Serena's personal experience contradicts a little bit of what you were saying, but I guess, do you have a reaction to that?
It absolutely doesn't contradict it. By definition, if Serena, if you were getting high from the dose, it was not a stable dose. A stable dose, by definition, does not get you high. There's been tons of research and tons of people that would say it doesn't get you high. So that's one person's experience. One of the problems we have with methadone is there's 800,000 patients on methadone in this country for the treatment of pain. And from a pain clinic, pain doctors a lot of times don't prescribe it safely or responsibly. And so, there's a lot of states that are really cutting completely back on methadone being prescribed for pain. In an opioid treatment program where it's prescribed responsibly, if we ever had a patient say, I'm feeling euphoria or I'm nodding off because of the methadone, we would adjust the dose accordingly. We would never allow somebody to feel euphoria from the methadone.
When you say feel euphoria, can you describe that?
Well, it's an opiate. It could get you high. I don't think it gets you as high as heroin because, like I said, it's a slow onset. It's got opiate. It's got a longer half-life, which is why it is a very and it's really cheap, which is why it's a lot of times a preferred medication in pain management. But it does, like all opiates, like a lot of medications, you know, people could get high off Adderall if they abuse it or if they're given the incorrect dose. And a lot of times it's about finding the stable dose, the therapeutic dose, which, you know, by definition, if it's therapeutic, if it's a stable dose, it's not getting you high.
And Carl, you've worked with a lot of people who have experiences with different opioids. What's your reaction to this conversation?
Yeah, it's really difficult because, you know, that it's based on the client or the patient's report, right? So a patient is very unlikely to report euphoric feelings. But they can also, the flip side of that is they can report withdrawal symptoms and get an increase in their methadone prescription, right? So if I come in as a person suffering from a substance use disorder, right, and Nick is absolutely right, my brain chemistry has changed. I've associated my addiction with the same kind of mentality that I associate my survival, right? Like the same parts of my brain are firing when, you know, I want to drink water or when I eat or when I want to procreate. Like all of those things are the same areas of the brain that are firing when, like, I start to crave my drug of choice. So I come in with that kind of manipulative behavior and that mentality, and it's very easy to manipulate that system because there is no way of really measuring, where euphoric feeling is starting, where it's not starting, you know, where withdrawal symptoms you can scale some withdrawal symptoms, but it's really it's a slippery slope and it's kind of a tricky field. Across the board, not just methadone, but Suboxone and as well. And there's a lot of different kinds of clinics. You know, what Nick is doing is very different than some of the other clinics that you can get these medications from.
How so? Tell me the differences that you see.
So community medical services, and Nick would probably be a better spokesperson for them. But there's the entire clinic is about addiction recovery. Mm-hmm. Whereas other providers, there's, you know, huge box store providers that are doing everything from dentistry to general practice medicine to pain management, and then they've gotten an X-day designation and are able to prescribe Suboxone. So when the Comprehensive Addiction Recovery Act passed, they went from 100 patient max.
Let's pause here, okay. because now we're jumping into the next medication, and so I want to make sure that people understand what that is. So Suboxone, what is Suboxone, and what are other names for it?
Suboxone, Subutex, buprenorphine. Okay. Yeah, that's the main active ingredient. Subutex doesn't have the opiate blocker naloxone, mm-hmm. and Suboxone does. I've taken Subutex for 4 years.
And Nick, do you guys, you have methadone at your clinic, but you also have Suboxone?
Yeah, absolutely. We use Suboxone, buprenorphine, methadone, and Vivitrol.
Okay, so what does buprenorphine do that's different than methadone?
So it's actually pretty similar to methadone. Methadone's a full agonist, meaning it fills the opiate receptor in your brain. Suboxone or buprenorphine is a partial agonist, so it partially fills the receptor in your brain. And then Vivitrol, we get to that later, but it's it's an antagonist. It blocks the receptor.
Okay.
And so so there is a ceiling effect for Suboxone. So anything over 32 milligrams, you can't go any higher than 32 milligrams. So if somebody's got a long history of drug abuse and they have the genetic predisposition to need high doses of methadone or Suboxone, Suboxone won't work for them if they need a higher dose because it's got a ceiling effect. That being said, and this is a point I'll probably make throughout this program, mm-hmm. it's pretty much based on genetics. Different medications work for different people. Just like, you know, typically it takes 2 to 3 antidepressants before somebody with depression finds the medication that works best for them. And so with each of these medications, we have a lot of patients on Suboxone who said methadone did absolutely nothing for me. And we have patients on methadone who said Suboxone did nothing for me. I could tell you personally, acetaminophen does absolutely nothing for me. I have to take ibuprofen when I have a headache. And so it's really, and it really comes down to genetics, what genotypes people have that causes them to react to a specific medication. But there are studies that show what percentage of the population tends to respond better to which medications.
Okay. And Serena, you have experience with, so what were your initial reactions to Nick's comments?
I'm not a doctor and.
No, from your personal experience.
Like he's right about the Suboxone being partial and, you know, obviously that's fact. But as someone who's taken both medications, and I took Subutex for 4 years. The ceiling effect is true, but not everyone's, like he was saying, everyone's, you know, built differently and they're going to react different to a certain dose. And so what I've noticed, and I've also been a part of Suboxone and Subutex and methadone support groups for a long time, everyone's ceiling is different.
What do you mean ceiling?
Like it doesn't work past a certain dose. So what he's saying is past 32 milligrams, which I believe is the max dose, it doesn't do anything for you.
So like it doesn't block your cravings. It doesn't do, like it doesn't,
it won't
what doesn't
give
it
you
do?
A buzz. It's not going to get you higher. It's not going to work any better than your ceiling dose. So you tap out at a certain dose. You try to take more. You're not going to feel it.
Okay.
A difference. Like with methadone, you take more, you're going to feel it.
Okay. So then if you've hit that ceiling, the more you take, like it just gets the opioid in your system and then it's dangerous, but you don't feel different or I don't know. Nick, can you explain that?
Well, yeah. So it's it doesn't get absorbed by your opioid receptors. Simply that. You have a limited amount of opioid receptors that can be filled with the Suboxone, and so any more you take, you could absolutely, I don't know if you could overdose on buprenorphine. I've never heard of that happening. I'm sure you can, but it would probably take a lot for that to happen.
Serena's nodding.
Yeah, I know of individuals that have overdosed on Suboxone.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'd like to invite a caller onto the program. We have Tristan from Fairbanks. Tristan, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Thank you. I just wanted to touch on some of the comments that were made at the beginning of the show about just from my observations about people that are in the methadone program and the effect that methadone has on them.
Do you have experience with the methadone program?
What's that?
Hey, You worked as a nurse. Continue.
Yeah, I worked as a nurse for women in the postpartum period that were members of the program. And then I worked in the nursery, and so I would care for their babies when they weren't there for their babies. And then when they generally, the schedule would be that right after they'd had their treatment at the methadone program, they would come over and then spend the course of the day being with their baby. And it was not uncommon to observe women in a state that Serena described, where they were very nodding off. It was difficult for them at times to open their eyes. And they, you know, just kind of listing in the chair often. My purpose of bringing that up, I guess, is just to talk about my observations. I don't have any, for me, I'm not a doctor. I don't have any judgment about the prescription doses for individual people. And I think that our program in Fairbanks does a tremendous job, and their provider is very responsible. But I just wanted to touch on Serena's, what she said, that there does seem to be a tendency with methadone that you do get high, and I witnessed that myself in my job, and so I'll just leave it there. That I find that area is very fragile, you know, in treating people to on maintenance doses and attempting to find that sweet spot where they aren't. And, you know, be mothers, like, do not be in a state where they're having difficulty staying awake, being in a very drowsy state, you know. So that's all I have to say about that.
Well, thanks very much for calling in, Tristan. I appreciate your comments. And Serena, you're nodding in the corner. Do you...
You know, I'm pro maintenance medications, because there are people out there that their lives are at risk every day that they're using heroin or, you know, illicit drugs. And so I believe there's a place for it. So I'm pro it to an extent. You know, there's individuals where Suboxone doesn't work, where Vivitrol isn't working yet, or they're not able to get to their Vivitrol. But, you know, I have seen people change their lives around with methadone. But from someone who's taken methadone, I was high every day for 3 years.
Nick, how do you react to all of this? I mean, have you heard all these experiences before?
Yeah, absolutely. And I never said methadone can't get you high. I mean, I think that's the first thing I said, is there's abuse potential there. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of issues with methadone. One of the problems is it is often irresponsibly prescribed from methadone clinics. You know, there's a lot of bad methadone clinics throughout the country that, like Carl was saying, they're considered a dose and go clinic where they don't provide sufficient and adequate psychosocial counseling. There's absolute overdose potential with methadone. It's very, it is a very dangerous form of treatment. I think we are all, Serena, Carl, and I, and everybody in the treatment community, we're on the same page. Mm-hmm. Our end state is exactly the same. It's to keep people alive. I mean, that's the bottom line. That is the number one outcome we're looking for. And if you compare medication-assisted treatment, methadone in particular, against any other modality of treatment for treating opioid use disorder, it is the most effective treatment. There's studies that have looked at, you know, 30-year outcomes for methadone treatment. There's a study out of Australia that followed heroin users over a 30-year period, and there's not a lot of longitudinal studies in this field, but this one in particular looked at patients over a 30-year period. The only difference between those that were alive and those that were dead after 30 years was whether or not they were receiving methadone. That is it.
I want to chime in real quick, though. Absolutely, it's super important that we're keeping people alive first and foremost, but I really don't want that to be the only measure of success, right? Like, because if we're only measuring alive versus death, then we're not accounting for quality of life, we're not accounting for recovery, we're not accounting for reintegration of these individuals into the community and productive lifestyles.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to say that that's the only metric we look at, but at the end of the day, that is the most important metric.
I mean, maybe. Yeah, I mean, I think we have to be really careful about how we interact with patients or individuals, and we say, okay, like, if my only objective is to keep you alive for the next 5 years or 10 years or for the rest of your life by prescribing this to you, and that's the only measure that we, the only intervention that we use, I think we're kind of missing a whole lot. And you also mentioned something about different strokes for different folks, but I don't know if that's the case with all these medications. I think on a biological level, they all work the same for everyone. It doesn't matter if I come in or Serena comes in or you come in. The Vivitrol is going to block the opiate receptors in my brain just like it's going to block the opiate receptors
Carl,
in everyone.
That's actually not true, though. There was a combined study that shows you have to have a specific genotype for naltrexone, and less than 25% of the U.S. population has the genotype. And it's just like I said with acetaminophen. It doesn't phase me. So no, it does not block the opioid receptors for all people. 75% of the population, you give them Vivitrol, and it will have absolutely no effect whatsoever.
Is there a study about Vivitrol that shows that?
There's absolutely a study. It's a combined study.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, sorry.
Okay, I guess let me just jump in. For listeners who don't know, we're discussing different types of medication, and currently the conversation is about, okay, well, what works differently for other people? And Vivitrol is this long-acting injection of naltrexone, and the idea is that it blocks your cravings and you only get an injection once a month.
Yeah, let's talk about it real quick.
Yeah. Yeah.
What Vivitrol is.
So okay, because you're a big Vivitrol proponent.
I'm a huge supporter of Vivitrol. Vivitrol is a shot. It's a suspension drug that gets suspended under the skin of the patient that's using it, right? And it lasts for 28 days. So it blocks the opiate receptors in that individual's brain so that effectively they can't get high. So it reduces the cravings. It reduces their ability to actually use an opiate and feel euphoric effects from it.
Mm-hmm.
And it can't be abused or diverted. You can't get intoxicated from it.
In fact, if you drink on it, you get pretty
or
ill.
Or withdrawal, right? So one thing that we have not discussed whatsoever about methadone and Suboxone is that once a person starts that program, if they want to come off of it, they're going to experience ridiculous withdrawal symptoms.
I actually have an email about that that I'd like to jump to because it fits in. And this is from Austin. And Austin writes, I wanted to make note that while methadone is important for helping people to successfully withdraw off of shorter acting opioids, there is a problem of what happens with methadone addiction. I had a friend who became addicted to methadone, and the withdrawal was so much longer than the withdrawal for shorter acting opioids and made it extremely difficult for them to come off of the drug. Mm-hmm. And Serena, do you have personal experiences with that?
Yes, absolutely. I was on methadone at a stable dose for 3 years.
And you were prescribed for pain?
Yes, for pain. Mm-hmm. And I ended up pregnant with my youngest child, and I ended up switching to Subutex. But the transition from methadone to Subutex, I thought my baby was going to die in that first week. It took a week to get through withdrawals to change over to Subutex. But in the past 4 years, trying to get off Subutex, I tried on multiple occasions in many different ways, and it never worked until now with the bridge. It is the hardest. I told all my colleagues I'd rather be coming off of heroin right now
than coming off of methadone.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so to say that we're using methadone or Suboxone to manage or to mitigate people's withdrawal symptoms is kind of silly, because we're not. We're continuing to have that individual on opiates. They still have to manage withdrawal symptoms if they wanted to come off of them.
And Nick, you weren't saying that methadone was used to manage withdrawal, were you?
It is absolutely managed.
Oh, okay.
It is used to manage withdrawals, and it is true. I think detoxing from methadone is probably harder. It is harder than detoxing from heroin, from what I've heard. I think one of the differences, though, is that when somebody's trying to detox off heroin, they typically don't have a strong support system in place when that's happening. A lot of times methadone treatment is used to get a patient in a stable place. So maybe after 2 years of treatment, let's say, where they're in a more stable place in life, and then they're able to detox off the methadone, it's still going to physiologically be very, very difficult, but hopefully they'll be in a better state to withdraw or to detox or to titrate.
So better state meaning like more support networks.
More support. Yeah, I mean it's like all medications for treating psychiatric disorders. You know, you give a patient SSRIs for depression or you know different medications for depression or anxiety to stabilize them so that you could then deal with the psychosocial root cause of their addiction once they're in a more stable place, and then the detox becomes a bit more manageable. But I'll absolutely agree that detoxing from methadone is very difficult.
So we're gonna jump to a call. Anna, who is in Fairbanks. Anna, welcome to the program.
Thanks. I'm not sure if I'm jumping back or not, but I work in the methadone clinic in Fairbanks, and we have discussions about dose stability all the time, obviously. And while indeed some new patients aren't going to report if they feel euphoria or more likely sedation from having too much methadone, their behavior is observable if you're seeing them in groups, in individual sessions, and so nodding isn't acceptable. For the nurse who sees moms nodding at the hospital, I got to wonder, did you talk with her about it? Did you talk with her doctor about it? Because, again, having been a new mom, I know I was exhausted. How much is the methadone and how much is not? I just wanted to reiterate that I think at least our methadone program we go out of our way to help people find a dose that actually helps them function without any euphoria. So mm-hmm. they are feeling normal. And
I agree that that is definitely the goal, and our healthcare professionals, I believe them when they make statements such as that. Unfortunately, I think it's the minority that actually gets that kind of treatment.
Right, and that's too bad because we can, like I said, we can all work together to make sure that doesn't happen. I also wonder, are there other drugs on board? You know,
exactly.
We cannot control what people are doing outside of our clinic, and while we do assess and do urine screens, we cannot control everything. So, I guess that's my comment here, other than it does work better for different people, and we support people trying to get off. Methadone is usually the last stop for people who have tried many times to get off heroin or other opioids. So the relapse rate from methadone or other opiates is pretty high once you've gone off. So some people aren't willing to do that anymore after years and years of trying.
Mm-hmm. So I was talking to a doctor the other day who was talking about using Suboxone in primary care clinics and the importance of just getting this drug to people. Because it normalizes your brain and you can function better when you're on Suboxone than on heroin. And he's like, some people will just be on these medications for the rest of their lives, just like some people will be on antidepressants for the rest of their lives. What are people's reactions to that or thoughts about that?
I personally think that is ridiculous that doctors are telling patients that they have to be on it for the rest of their lives. Because if somebody had told me that, you know, you trust your doctor,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Well, I mean, I don't think he's telling people that. I think he's just like, listen, some people are on this for 8-9 years.
But some doctors do. And I'm telling mm-hmm. you from personal experience and the people that I know in my support groups online, there are doctors out there in our country that are saying you have to be on it for the rest of your life. So there are doctors. I'm not saying this particular doctor, but I think that there should always be a plan, you know, set in place. I know everybody's different. Everybody gets their lives back and at a different pace. So everybody's different. But, you know, some people it takes longer. Some people it doesn't. I think they're prescribed at too high of doses. I think that some people go way too long. And because the one thing that you're not told is, hey, you know, just so you know, before you take this medication and when you're ready to get off, it's going to be a really hard, difficult detox. Even tapering. I've tapered over a long period of time and it just didn't work.
We are going to take a quick break and then we're going to come back to some more callers. You're listening to Talk of Alaska.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com.
And by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, now distributing Boss Industrial Log Splitters, stocking gas and electric up to 34 ton. On the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today we're discussing medication-assisted treatment. And we have in the studio Serena Espinoza and Carl Soderstrom, both who are working up in the Valley. And then from Arizona, we have Nick Stavros, who works at Community Medical Services. If you have comments on medication-assisted treatments, we're talking about methadone, Suboxone and Vivitrol, please call us at 1-800-478-8255. You can also email us at talk@alaskapublic.org. And we are now going to Roger in White Mountain. Roger, welcome to the program.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
Can methadone be safely used if you use Paxil, Lipitor, and Nexultri daily, like many people do? Nexultri supports anti-depression, like Prozac, to minimize depression. I'll hang up and listen to your response. Thank you.
Thank you for calling, Roger.
Well, unfortunately, none of us are actually doctors or providers to answer that question.
I don't think any of us would feel comfortable, answering
that. At least what you will find is that every prescriber is a doctor, so that would be an appropriate person to ask a local provider. I wanted to touch real quick on the question that you had just recently asked, which was, talking about the primary care clinics, right? So I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, mm-hmm. and I want everyone listening to understand that there are some differences in the providers that you can receive these drugs from, right? So Community Medical Services, for example, is a provider solely in addiction recovery treatment, whereas other clinics that are doing all kinds of other things inside their clinic, as well as addiction recovery treatment. We even have pain clinics that'll do addiction recovery treatment in Suboxone. There's a huge difference. And I think that we, as a state, are getting those lines blurry. We lose the A and the T when we have a primary care provider prescribing, right?
The A and the T.
Yeah, the assisting treatment, right? So what we're doing is we're saying, welcome, I see you have a problem today. Let me give you this pill, and I hope it helps. Come back and see me and let me know how that works for you. We're losing all the psychoeducation. We're the biopsychosocial factors that are contributing to an individual's addiction.
So, but some of the studies are saying that
buprenorphine.
Let's just go with Suboxone.
Okay.
some of the studies are saying that people with on Suboxone, like, it's just as effective without treatment. Like, if people aren't willing to go and have counseling or go to group treatment,
I'd really love to see who's paying for those studies, right?
Well,
and Nick, jump in. Yeah.
And I talked to you about this because I have some medical directors who say, that's, you'll hear that a lot from the medical community. I mean, ASAM, American Society of Addiction Medicine, mm-hmm. will ASAM certified doctors will say, yes, it's the buprenorphine that's contributing to the recovery rather than the counseling. And my problem with that is there's pretty extensive research showing just that you compare buprenorphine with counseling versus buprenorphine without counseling, and you have the exact same effects. But I would say, how good is that counseling that's being provided? Because there's also studies that show very specific types of counseling in conjunction with medication actually increase the chances for recovery. So I would, I tend to always go back to the research. I don't like to rely on anecdotal, experience or evidence, because we live in a day of empirical evidence where we have mounds of meta-analyses and research that we could rely on. But there is research that shows both. So I choose to believe that if you provide the right psychosocial counseling in conjunction with the medication, you're going to see very different outcomes than you typically see out of a typical OTP or behavioral health clinic just providing opioid treatment program like ours, that's just providing the bare minimum amount of therapy.
And I can attest to that being correct. When I took Subutex, I did not go to counseling or, you know, meetings. But, I mean, I go to church and God is my, you know, he's my support. And that's what, you know, that's what helps me. And that's my counseling. But I can agree with that. You know, Subutex served a purpose for me. My life was so much better. I had more clarity when I switched from methadone to Subutex. So, you know, I can see how that would be, but every individual is different. And it's also about what they're truly wanting and if they're truly wanting to get clean and sober and they want to change their entire lifestyle for recovery.
And I also, I get the importance of research, but I work with individuals on a daily basis all day long. So I'm seeing it on a daily basis. And I don't want to be naive to the fact that Suboxone and some of these maintenance drugs are causing a huge problem in our community. An example of that, where drugs used to be in all over our prisons and jails, right? That's not a new fact. But today, in the Department of Corrections in the state of Alaska, the most found drug is Suboxone, right? It's the most averted. And we're seeing clinics that I could go in and fail a drug test for other substances, get my prescription, and get Medicaid to pay for a subscription of Suboxone that then has a street value of thousands of dollars that I can then turn and continue to perpetuate my other habits. And then I can take a few of them, go to the doctor, get another script. So that's problematic to me as a taxpayer and as a community member that we're not addressing these kind of concerns. I'm very active in the recovery community. I've literally worked with thousands of individuals who have overcome addiction or have tried to overcome addiction or are currently doing that. And I would say that a very small percentage, from 1 to 5% are people that are actively using medicated-assisted treatment.
Carl's absolutely right. It is the most diverted medication because people have to work their way up with their provider. You know, you come in for a week and then come in for another week and then you work up to a month and then sometimes every 2 months. I didn't, you know, I was taking my medication responsibly, but I was getting, a script for every 2 months. But there are places that are offering Suboxone just like they do methadone. You have to come in for daily doses. You're required to do counseling and meetings and group. And I think that would benefit the people that are using Suboxone so much more better than handing them a script and sending them out the door.
And Nick, do you agree with that?
Absolutely. We, unfortunately, Serena, we have pretty stringent requirements for Suboxone in our clinics, and a lot of patients choose to go to OBOTs or office-based opioid treatment programs, which are doctor's offices, because there's less requirements. You know, we do diversion calls in our clinics where we call our patients randomly and have them bring in their prescription to make sure that they have the adequate amount to make sure they're not diverting it. But if the state of Kentucky has said that they have a Suboxone epidemic. It's the number one drug epidemic in the state. And honestly, at the federal level, the Department of Health and Human Services is, in my opinion, turning a blind eye to that fact. They acknowledge that Suboxone is very, very diverted, but they consider it still therapeutic. Even if it's being diverted, people are turning around and selling it, on the streets, and they think it's still therapeutic. So from their perspective, it's like, oh, just get more Suboxone out there, which I don't think is a good idea. You're starting to hear, there's a negative association with methadone because when methadone programs started in the 1970s, there was a lot of bad methadone programs. And now you have, the word methadone itself is a terrible branding. I mean, it sounds like methamphetamines, and it's like, you know, it's developed over the last 40 years, and Suboxone's getting the same reputation because it is being so negligently, prescribed, and it's terrible because it is a good medication for a lot of people. But a very, very typical business model is the average dose of Suboxone you might see in a practice is 32 milligrams. But the average therapeutic dose across the country is 12 to 16 milligrams. That means a lot of practices are over-prescribing Suboxone. Patients are turning around, selling it on the streets, and taking the dose that they need. And then using that money, a lot of times they're using that money to pay for treatments for the 16 milligrams that they do need. But it's a very well-known business model that's leading to a ton of Suboxone being diverted onto the streets. So we try to advocate starting patients on Suboxone in a methadone clinic, in an OTP where it's a more stable environment, and then transitioning them into an OBOT once they're stabilized, or a doctor's office or another behavioral health facility.
And I would like to invite Dennis from Kodiak onto the program. Dennis.
Greetings. Great show. I just happened to turn on the radio, and I knew the show was coming, and I anticipated sharing what I learned here in Juneau recently. In February, I had the good fortune with a couple of public servants to attend the governor's panel on the opiate drug. And with empathy, I understand everything I've heard so far, and it's so profound to hear out of the shadows. We don't have to be ignorant anymore. And we're gearing up this week to bring in the heavy hitters. And I've heard that story, the drug dealer becomes the drug dealer, in recovery. And pow, another learning lesson. But a big salute to anybody who is willing to step forward in their profession to shed light on the subject. And I can only begin to tell you how ugly things have got in Kodiak. We talked about a four-time increase in the opiate drug overuse. Well, times that by 10, and that's what we got going on in Kodiak. We had a gathering about a year and a half ago, and everybody was optimistic about what was going to come out of it. Unfortunately, nothing came out of it that dealt with the problem. So it's good news to know that there are people out there standing by to help communities like Kodiak actually deal with the problem. So with that, another salute. Thank you so much for having such a profound show on the air.
Thank you very much for calling, Dennis. This conversation leads me straight to an email that we've received from Jill Green. She says, as a primary care nurse practitioner who treats opioid-dependent patients, I have not met a single patient who felt that Suboxone or methadone was truly harm reduction and the path to overcoming opioid dependency. They all described a version of their Suboxone prescriptions so they can purchase heroin, which results in a better high. They described the still high brain when taking methadone. I have had many patients go back to heroin from Suboxone or methadone as the detox is quicker and easier. Why is Vivitrol utilization lagging far behind Suboxone and methadone utilization in Alaska? How can we get the rural communities to utilize Vivitrol to assist in the treatment of opioid dependency? All right, let's go.
Yes,
well,
thank
okay.
you, Jill.
Let's first, before we answer that, I would love one of you guys to really describe Vivitrol and what makes it different.
Well, I can. Okay. I'm on Vivitrol.
Okay, tell me about it.
So Vivitrol and I think it's amazing. I didn't hear about it until, a year ago. When, I don't know when it came out. But once someone's on Vivitrol, it's a tool. It is not the fix-all. It's not the answer. They need, peer support. They need to go into a treatment program. They need to be productive, It's just a tool because, people can relapse by the end and not get their second shot. And I always tell my patients the second shot's probably the most important shot, not the first one.
Wait, so pause right there. The problem is, and Nick, please tell me if you've seen similar. The problem is that you get the first shot, it cuts your cravings.
It blocks your opiates from receiving any. You cannot get high while on Vivitrol.
It's like a wall.
It is.
It
covers your receptors completely.
Okay.
And so I've heard of people saying it does help cut cravings. I don't know personally because I'm done.
You're mentally done.
And I chose to get on Vivitrol because I've been off and on substances for the past 18 years. And I want my brain to rewire, replenish. And I don't want to be put in a situation where maybe I would take a pill. Because I have chronic pain too, so I have committed to doing a year. But Vivitrol is amazing. But the hard part is getting people, especially on maintenance medications, to the shot. Even we've even seen our patients in this Lazarus Project. They have a hard time getting through the 7 days to get their shot.
What's the Lazarus Project?
The Lazarus Project. We're utilizing the bridge device out in the valley. My ministry, Fiend to Clean, a couple other partners, and three treatment providers. It's a pilot study. That utilizes the bridge device, and Jill Green also provides it now here in Anchorage, and it's a little neurostim device that sends pulses and signals to the
pain sensors in your brain, and it can stop withdrawal symptoms anywhere from 75% to 100%.
Okay, so it's basically this little tiny machine you attach to your ear. It sends neurostimulator. It cuts your withdrawal symptoms so that, because you have to be off of drugs before you can get Vivitrol.
Yes.
7 days off of opiates. Okay. Otherwise, the Vivitrol shot will make you experience severe withdrawal symptoms.
Severe.
So the difficulty is getting people from day zero to day seven. With the Lazarus Project, we're using a non-narcotic approach, which includes prescription maintenance or prescription comfort medications, you know, like anti-nausea meds and sleeping meds and stuff like that, as well as this neurostim device that gets people from day zero to day seven. And thank you, Jill, for standing up and saying that, because it's absolutely true. Vivitrol is kind of a far behind it, and I think honestly part of the problem is money, right? Because as a doctor or as a prescriber, we're making customers, not curing our patients. I think it's a lot easier to say come in every day or once a week to get this prescription than it is to say come in once a month.
It's easier to say that than, I mean, I thought.
Well, it's financially, yeah, absolutely. So I can prescribe, I can have customers come in for the rest of their life to be on this drug, or I can prescribe them a Vivitrol shot and only see them once a month.
But Nick, you guys also have Vivitrol, correct?
Yeah, we do.
Yeah, and
we offer all three options. So, but it's the same thing. If a patient comes in for a Vivitrol shot, they only have, I mean, by regulation, you know, regulations don't make them come in every day like they do with methadone or Suboxone, and so it's the regulations make it a lot more accommodating. So they only have to come in once a month. Now they might have to come in more often for counseling or provider visits, you know, as needed.
And do you require counseling with Vivitrol?
Yes, we do. We require counseling for everything. The majority of what our program does is the counseling portion.
And not the medication portion.
Well, if you go into a typical clinic, you know, 80% of our staff is going to be counselors. And so we do specialize in the medication portion of it. But it's absolutely we don't call ourselves a methadone clinic. We call ourselves an opioid treatment program because we do all three medications. But yeah, the psychosocial counseling component is the biggest part of what we do.
So let's talk Vivitrol. Complaints I've heard are it's super expensive. It's like $1,000 a shot.
Or more.
Or more, if you don't have Medicaid, mm-hmm. especially. I've heard people will get one or two shots, and they're like, oh, this is awesome. I'm good. And mm-hmm. then they stop.
Mm-hmm.
How do we solve these problems?
We stop thinking that there's a magic pill that's going to fix addiction recovery. There is not a cure-all. If there was a magic pill that cured addiction, I'd take two. That's the way addicts think, right?
Because we're addicts.
Exactly. You know, I think that we have to get into a mentality that it's a tool, it's a short-term tool, and it's a last resort tool, right? Addiction recovery takes community-based efforts. It takes treatment. It's biopsychosocial education and psychoeducation. And it takes a lot of, like, resolve from the individual.
Can we just pause?
Mm-hmm.
Biopsychosocial education?
Yeah, so, like, there's the biological factors, the social factors, and then, like, the biological psycho is, like, the other thing. So, like, drugs and alcohol were never a problem for me, right? They were a solution for me, right? So, like, I had to get to the underlying issues that made me uncomfortable in my own skin, that made me want to utilize drugs and alcohol as a solution, right? So, like, the things that were happening in my life, the ACEs are a predisposition or a precursor to addiction, right? Adverse childhood experiences, right? So trauma. I can't just take a pill and think that it's going to cure the traumas in my life, right? Like, I have to address all these factors in order for me to fully recover and to reintegrate into the community, right? Because if I'm walking around with shame and trauma and depression and all these factors that are being mulled up from the past, then, you know, I'm not going to be motivated. I'm not going to reintegrate into the community. What I need to do is address those things. And then I also need to incorporate the non-clinical components, which are housing, education, employment, right? Recovery, community. You know, when I introduce those things into a person who's entering into recovery's lives, we see increased quality of life. That's the goal every time, right? You know, when we put somebody on a maintenance drug and we just kind of leave them on a maintenance drug, they're kind of plateaued. When we're not addressing these biopsychosocial factors, we're not we're not encouraging that individual to increase their quality of life and reintegrate into the community.
And I want to stress how important peer support is. You know, what Fiend to Clean is doing is incredible, because had peer support been around back when I was using hardcore drugs, I think a lot would have changed for me, because what they're doing is they're doing a lot for individuals, and people need that support. It's huge.
And we're going to take a quick break before coming back to some more calls, like Ralph from Fairbanks.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. Alaska Pacific University delivers a distinctive educational adventure designed to support your personal and professional goals. Their online, evening, and campus-based courses make education accessible and will fit into any busy schedule. Be motivated by a devoted faculty and creative, independent-minded students. Apply now at alaskapacific.edu. Moving life ahead with APU. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Ralph in Fairbanks is on the line. Ralph, thanks for being on the show.
Well, you've got quite a show going on here. So I'm an employer, mm-hmm. and I'm dealing with a person who's been an employee for me off and on for a couple years that is a heroin addict. Now, he's tried one of these things that was outside California, I think, somewhere, that was supposed to be a 30-day thing, and he lasted a couple of weeks in it. And he tells me that he cannot get Suboxone here in Fairbanks. Now, and that's what he wants. Now, after listening to a lot of what I've heard in this program, I'm not so certain that that's advantageous. And what I'm really looking for are alternatives. I mean, this is a bright guy and does good work. He is strung out on horse.
We're not saying that Suboxone and methadone is not a good option. It just depends on the individual.
And there's other options. Who is the provider that does the bridge in Paul?
Paul Finch does the bridge and Vivitrol treatment.
In Fairbanks.
In
that
Fairbanks.
Might be a person that would be a good resource for you and your employee.
We have Paul, so, did you say his name was?
Paul Finch. Yep, Paul Finch.
Finch, okay.
I can't think of his practice, but he utilizes the bridge.
I'll find him.
So this, there are other alternatives. Go ahead, Nick, sorry.
Well, if I could, I mean, and this just touches upon a point. That's the danger of this entire conversation, is you would never, and you guys would not host a show where we sit here and debate the efficacy of different depression medications. Right. I mean, different. What's better? You know, Adderall or Vyvanse or Strattera for treating ADD, mm-hmm. for instance. Mm-hmm. Yet there's I do point the finger at the pharmaceutical companies a lot of times. The makers of Vivitrol and Suboxone a lot of times are, you know, trying to point fingers at other modalities of treatment, or especially methadone, and say, hey, this is a bad form of treatment, when the research does show that methadone tends to work for more, I'm not going to say it's better, but tends to work for more people than Suboxone or Vivitrol. If you look at retention rates with accompanying ceasing of using the illicit opiate, the retention rate for over a 3-month period for Vivitrol is 15%. Over a 1-year period for Suboxone, it's 40 to 50%. And for methadone, it's 50 to 80%. So the research shows that for long-term treatment, methadone works for the most people and is a lot of times a life-saving treatment. So when we have this conversation, it does sometimes deter people from receiving the one medication that works for them. A recent article just came out in Addiction, which is a national publication talking about the disease of addiction, and it was saying, you know, we shouldn't even call it medication-assisted treatment. We should call it treatment, first of all, because you wouldn't call, you know, giving insulin to a diabetic medication-assisted treatment. You would just call it treatment for diabetes. This and medication-assisted treatment is the gold standard of treatment for addiction. 28-day residential treatment is not adequate for treating addiction. Detoxing patients as a first line of defense who are opioid diagnosed with opioid use disorder is not a form of treatment. We know what treatment works. We have mounds and years of research. And Carl, I know you said, you know, you see this every day, but if you line up 10,000 people who work in the behavioral health field, they're all going to say this is the right way to treat people because this is what I've seen. And you can't have 10,000 right answers. You have one right answer for every person. So recommending to that to the caller that just called, well, the bridge device and Vivitrol, you know, the research shows that Vivitrol, there's not a single study that shows Vivitrol is more effective than a placebo over after 1 year in treatment. Now, that doesn't mean much because there's just not a lot of research out there showing Vivitrol being taken for 4 or 5 years. But to recommend to somebody the form of treatment that has the least amount of research, not to mention you could treat 14 people with methadone for the same cost of treating one person with Vivitrol. You know, people, we have this conversation and it really deters people from entering treatment. I mean, I get calls from parents all the time who say, I don't want my kid on methadone or Suboxone, I want them on Vivitrol. And my response is always, let the person who's going through this make the decision on their own. It's not up to you as a parent to decide that for them.
Let me just chime in real quick, though. The recommendation wasn't Vivitrol. The recommendation was a bridge device to get that individual through withdrawal symptoms. My recommendation, hands down, every single time, is not a medication.
Really?
Absolutely, period.
Even though studies have shown that...
Whose studies? Who's going to pay for that? Who? Big Pharma is obviously paying for the studies.
No, absolutely not. You could see who's contributing to the study. For instance, the Alkermes study that was done in Russia to get FDA approval for Vivitrol.
The studies are great.
Four of the people on that study.
We're talking about studies that are being conducted by individuals that are not interacting on a daily basis with addiction recovery. So, like,
but Carl, that's not true. They are. So should we throw science out the window completely?
Yeah, but no, you're not going to convince me just by saying the word study that I'm wrong and that this is the greatest thing and that it's the gold standard because you say that there's a study that says it's the gold standard.
Well,
right?
And also, like, personal experience.
Yeah.
How many individuals that are working in this field have actual personal experience with these types of medications?
Yeah, no,
there's research that points people in every direction.
But wait, so pause. Let Nick finish his point.
So one of the things I like to say, because I love philosophy. I don't want to sound anti-philosophy. I love it. In 500 BC, we did not have science. We had natural philosophy. Aristotle was considered a natural philosopher, one of the founders of modern-day science. That's before we had empirical research. Empirical research does peer-reviewed studies where we say, okay, let's try this and see what consequence it has. Let's try this and see what consequence it has. But when you start saying, let's not pay attention to the research, let's instead listen. I mean, I've heard Vivitrol called a miracle shot. I've heard that in every state across the country. That terminology comes directly from the pharmaceutical company makes Vivitrol.
We are wrapping
from the people that are using it, bro. I mean, I've interacted with the people sitting in the studio right now is a person that's tried all three avenues.
That's a sample. That's what I call a sample size of one, Carl.
That's not a sample size of one, bro. So, I work with thousands of people that feel the same way.
So obviously, this is still a subject that we are discussing to learn. To learn more, we'll post resources on our website, alaskapublic.org. I'd like to thank you all very much for joining us. We have Nick Stravos from Community Medical Services, Serena Espinoza from Fallen Up Ministries, and Carl Soderstrom, who is one of the founders of the peer support network, Fiend to Clean. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.